Hello and welcome to Systems of Harm, a podcast brought to you by Frankly Design. I'm your host, Amy Hupe, and each week I'll be speaking to a new guest about their experience of working with design systems and their personal experiences of marginalisation. In this week's episode, I am speaking to Cheryl Kababa. Cheryl works as Chief Design Officer at Substantial, and she's also a lecturer and an author. And in her recent book, Closing the Loop, Systems Thinking for Designers, Cheryl explores how our design work fits into the wider societal, economic, and political systems around us, and shares tools and frameworks for making the invisible visible. Cheryl's really kindly given us a discount code for her book for Systems of Harm listeners, which I'll share at the end of the episode. I can't wait to talk to Cheryl today. Let's get going. So Cheryl, thank you so much for joining us today on Systems of Harm. It's really exciting to have you on here. And this is the last episode of the series. So I'm really excited to talk to you because I think that your work and the things that you've written about really tie together nicely some of the themes that we've discussed in the podcast until now. So the very first sort of question I wanted to ask you is for you to kind of tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to be working in this space where you're thinking about systems and you're thinking about the kind of wider impact of design decisions.
Yeah, definitely. Happy to kind of talk about my background a little bit. So I really spent, you know, the first half of my career as a UX and product designer. So I worked for companies like Microsoft as well as Philips Design. And then I've moved, you know, over the last decade or so into design consulting. And this is where I've really sort of focused on the space of being a design researcher and design strategist. So it's kind of interesting, like that move was somewhat intentional because I felt a little bit like I didn't have a great deal of control as a product designer. You know, kind of like it felt like a lot of decisions had been made already. And a lot of the things I was interested in were the problem space and kind of like better understanding, you know, why we were kind of solving for certain things, as well as just kind of like the broader types of decision making about, you know, business or organization or what have you. And so that led me to really focus in my consulting life as a design researcher primarily. So basically trying to understand people's contexts and, you know, their relationships with the use of products and services in that space, and also in the role of being a consultant. So I've worked with consultancies like Frog and Adaptive Path, and most recently, I am at a small consultancy called Substantial. In that work, just because of my exposure to different organizations and how they operate, I was kind of like seeing the decision-making processes that are in place and also how things like organizational structure and culture kind of affect decision-making. And so kind of knowing that many like corporate entities that I was working with, you know, for example, I've worked with like the big technology companies, with like big healthcare and pharmaceutical companies, just kind of seeing how they were like making decisions, especially when they were design driven, on kind of based on the individual benefit of use and how people kind of interact with products and services in the moment, felt like it was too narrow a lens, especially when they were kind of designing things at scale. And that like felt like it leads to these repercussions when it comes to technology that I guess many of these teams and organizations didn't really feel equipped to deal with or to kind of think about, or, you know, just didn't have like processes and methods to engage with that kind of thinking. Like what happens, you know, beyond the direct benefit of use? Like, are you actually kind of mapping to not just the outcomes you want as a business, but also societal outcomes that you want to see as a business? And, or as individuals, even within your organization, like do the outcomes of like the work you're doing actually map to your own values? And so I started kind of incorporating many of the methods and practices that I write about in the book within my client work. So just kind of thinking about how do you create causal loops that kind of express how your product might, you know, interact out in the world? How do you extend your stakeholders beyond just thinking or advocating for end users if you're a designer, or beyond just like thinking about who your organizational stakeholders are? And I think that sort of felt to me like, oh, there's a lot of potential here in terms of how other designers could use this kind of thinking. And also, I feel like a lot of folks in the design practice are intimidated by sort of this systems thinking practice, just because it seems so, I don't know, formalized, abstract, sort of quantified. And I think I was just trying to fit it into my day-to-day work. And so that's a great deal of what I wrote about.
Yeah, I think, and it's so useful. As you said, I think it can be a really kind of intimidating thing for designers to start, you know, considering the wider context, especially because often we're working in a kind of environment where we're working to a tight deadline. We know we've got budgets to accommodate, and it can feel like, oh, well, this is just something that I don't have the space for. This is just something that I can't incorporate into my role. And I like the methods and the kind of the approaches that you talk about in the book, because they do feel really accessible. They feel like something that people can integrate into their existing work and not something they have to step outside to do. One thing that I wanted to ask you was, so you talked there and you talk in the book about thinking beyond, you know, the kind of direct usage of a product or a service and the impact that that has, but actually the wider impact on the people and their lives and the other kind of things that they're dealing with. And I wonder, does that impact extend beyond, not just into different sort of into the wider context of their life, but also over time? So you mentioned a couple of examples in the book about the sort of unintended consequences of some of the more kind of addictive behaviors that we've created through things like Instagram and Twitter with the infinite scroll that maybe weren't foreseen or maybe weren't considered enough at the outset. So is it, as well as thinking about the context in terms of breadth, I suppose, is it also thinking about it in terms of over time and how that might change?
It's a good question, because like I do talk a little bit about like as you're setting your vision, just kind of thinking about how things might play out in the future. So I touch a little bit on things like scenario mapping. I don't write in depth about it, but I do think like there are ways that you can kind of think about, you know, there are forecasting methods, for example, like backcasting from maybe the environment that, you know, products and services might exist within the future. And kind of thinking about how, like, those things would play out over time. I don't think, like, those kinds of methods are often considered as part of the, like, you know, a formalized systems thinking practice, but they're all systems thinking, because I really view it as, like, trying to extend your lens. I also think, like, maybe there's an approach like within the technology sector that could benefit from like, okay, so I do a lot of work, for example, in education. And so we're oftentimes thinking about outcomes and long-term outcomes when it comes to what do we want this to result in? What kind of impact do we want this to have like on students and their relationship with education in general? And I think like some of those methods, like creating a theory of change, for example, helps to address kind of like, what do you want to happen? Not just more broadly, but long-term. You know, I do a lot of work, for example, with the Gates Foundation. And I know like one of the things that, that philanthropy is always investing in is, kind of creating interventions that would eventually eradicate malaria. Like that is like a super long-term goal, right? Like you have to do a lot of incremental things in the meantime in order to achieve that. And so I think kind of like keeping that sort of end impact in mind, even as you're working on products where you're kind of like I don't know, you're kind of engaged in this very granular kind of problem solving or decision making is really important, because those things will or won't contribute to that eventual outcome.
Yeah, I think that's a really kind of poignant point to make, because some of the stuff that we've discussed in the series so far is around how we can make products and services more inclusive when we are often dealing with real kind of friction in our endeavor to do that. And so for me, it feels really important that we can make ourselves comfortable with that sense of incremental progress, and that any progress towards a long-term goal is something to be celebrated, is can be seen as a success, even though there may be some delay in achieving what we ultimately want to achieve. So an example I was talking about in the episode with Luke Murphy, who identifies as non-binary, and we spoke about trans exclusion and design systems, was the fact that we are often sort of working, when we're working on design systems, we're often focusing on making the front end of our services more inclusive by maybe offering a kind of non-binary option in a gender field, for example. But then the reality is often our back-end systems that are collecting the data and dealing with the data, and even the sort of organizational systems that sit behind those things, are set up in a way that is gender binary. So in the UK, for example, we have a lot of, you know, we have quite a lot of like boys and girls schools, for example, and we have, you know, male and female prisons and things like that. And so it can sometimes feel, I think, a little bit limited, like our power to affect those things. So how would you recommend people can kind of square that if they're working on a design system and they feel really we've only got control over the sort of front end aspect of this? How can they set themselves ambitious goals to make things more inclusive?
Yeah, I love that topic, because that's such a good example, just like how binary just forms are, for example, like, and it's just because of this, the ease of data collection in the background. It's not about like honoring who you are as an individual, as a user, as somebody who might be coming to the table with something the system doesn't expect. There's actually like a really good blog post from about 10 years ago, and I forget who wrote it, but he's a software engineer, and it's called 40 Things Programmers Believe About Names.
Oh, it's Patrick McKenzie, I think. And yeah, it's brilliant. I'll pop a link into the show notes, because it's definitely, yeah, I always refer to it. It's excellent.
Yes, it's really worth a read. And I was, you know, every time, I'm thinking about things like forms and how they're standardized, I think about that blog post, or even like decisions you're making within a design system. I think about that blog post because it's not just names. Like, there's all sorts of things that can be basically broken by the sort of cultural assumptions that we make about people's experiences or people's identity. And I think there's just an aspect of, as a designer, you kind of need to think about things in that way. Like, how can somebody like fall outside the norm that is informed by my own biases, by my own experiences, and like think about not just making assumptions about that, but actually engaging with folks who might fall outside of your assumed norms in the design research and design process. So if you're thinking about names, for example, it's like, what if you had people who kind of fell outside of those cultural norms involved in the design process, or you're conducting research with them? You would ultimately come up with a better solution that serves more people, that might make it more complicated in the back end, but that would actually, you know, facilitate a broader understanding of who your users are. So it's kind of funny, like even my own kids, they have two last names, and instead of a hyphen, there's a space in between their two last names. There's never been a healthcare, like an electronic record system, that gets that right. Whether it's like the airlines, whether it's, whoever our doctor is, it's just their schools. Like, they're we always have to like give both the names in order to understand where it's going to be listed, because sometimes it's listed under the first name, sometimes it's listed under the last name, the second name. So it's just it's really interesting kind of navigating that and understanding like the limitations of how we kind of think just about things like that, that feel like really granular problem solving, but have these repercussions beyond how we're thinking about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I have to say, like, my experience working in the UK government really sort of opened my eyes to some of these assumptions that I carried around what constitutes a name, you know. So like one thing that blew my mind was that you can have numbers in names, and that, you know, we often design forms in the UK with a kind of first name, last name structure. So it's like enter your first name, enter your last name. And there's often debate about what to call those. Do you call it kind of given name and family name? But actually, you know, certain cultures, I think Indonesia, for example, like it's not common to necessarily have that first name, last name format. So we're not always giving people the space to really kind of express themselves, really identify themselves within our services when we're introducing those assumptions. So, I think that's a really good point. What you just said there about kind of thinking about the people who fall outside of our assumed norms, and that how that kind of allows us to accommodate a broader set of identities, I suppose, in general. It reminds me of the Microsoft inclusion scale, and where they talk about kind of designing for disability. And if we think about people who are at the sort of permanent end of the disability scale, then we design implicitly for everybody else on that scale who are dealing with, you know, temporary or situational disabilities as well.
Yeah. I think, for example, like subtitles in streaming services are such a good example of that. I mean, and, you know, the idea that they kind of started out as essentially like a regulatory requirement. And but, you know, I mean, I don't know about you, but I have kids, so like I am always watching movies with like the subtitles on, because I can guarantee there is always something going on where it's like, I'm not going to hear the dialogue. There's too much going on. Also, try watching a movie like Tenet without subtitles on. It's just like beyond possible. And so I think, and, you know, curb cuts are another good example. And I think that does fall into like the realm of inclusive design. And I think there is an intersection between a lot of, like, my practice at Substantial is really oriented around equity-centered design. So, like, how do we kind of extend and better consider those who are typically marginalized within the design process, and extend power to them, like, within the research and strategy process, within the design process, as well as kind of designing with and for those at the margins. So with the idea that it should benefit other people who have more privileges within, you know, the systems for which you're designing. So it does map with that sort of like inclusive design principle, that if you design for those who typically have maybe like the worst outcomes in the system, who have like the worst interactions with the system, that you will likely benefit everybody else through doing that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's definitely true. And I also really like what you said there about kind of the shift of power, because essentially that's what we're trying to do a lot of the time here when we are focusing on, as you say, kind of equal design, like design and equity and design and inclusion, is we're thinking about how can we redress a power imbalance. So I think that sometimes it's that if we design for people at the margins, then we implicitly benefit everybody. Sometimes it's actually about accepting that we may take power away from some people and we may give it to other people. You know, we actually may flip that around. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, it's possible. And I think there is something, I think there's, this is where it's like really good to understand what people and groups and like stakeholders within the system are incentivized by. Because if they're incentivized by sort of power hoarding, like that's something that you would have to address. So if it's like, you know, if we look at like, let's say big technology companies and their consolidation, that's an aspect that sort of acts as an incentive to those kind of like in charge of those organizations. And so how do we essentially try to disrupt that if it feels like it's not benefiting others within the system, or if it's not resulting in sort of the societal impact that we, you know, that we want. And yeah, I mean, these are kind of like big questions, because a lot of times when, you know, I talk to design practitioners, the question always comes up about like, how can I even like do the things you're talking about when you talk about systems thinking, when I don't even have like control within my own team? Like, I'm just expected to kind of like stay in my lane and, you know, produce the design work. And I think part of it is that, like, I think there's a mindset shift that needs to happen a little bit, like in terms of, I don't know, disengaging a little bit with some of those like self-limiting points of view. Like, if you have good ideas within your organization, no matter how big, you should be able to surface them, or like find ways to surface them, even if it feels like there's a lot of barriers to that. And I think, yeah, just secondly, there's this notion of, I think designers actually have like a pretty good, I don't know, they have this really great ability with things like facilitation, with visualizing things in a, you know, non-narrative way, in a more visual way. And I think like that really sort of aligns with the idea of systems mapping for things like alignment, as well as the idea of engaging like broader stakeholders than who are normally engaged. I think it's like that stems from, yeah, some of these designer practice like sort of superpowers, which is like engaging with empathy. So kind of, you know, leaning into that ability to kind of engage other people who have different perspectives and bring that to the table, as well as you know, creative facilitation. And then again, sort of that, the approach that might lead to kind of like more visual mapping. These are all really good ways to gain alignment in a way that I think can be really powerful and can also sort of incrementally work to disrupt power imbalances within at least the work that you're doing directly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it reminds me of a quote that came up at the beginning of this series, which was by Sarah Wachtebecher, who wrote Technically Wrong and co-wrote Design for Real Life. And she says something that I love, which I think she wrote in a blog post maybe a couple of years ago, which is that often we get very fixated on, you know, do we have the power to change this? Do we have the power to improve this thing? And as if it's a binary thing. And actually a much more helpful question to ask ourselves is, what can we do from where we sit? And that actually everybody has an amount of power, and what can they do with it? How can they best apply it? And maybe, you know, what more would they need to increase that power? And I think that I really liked what you said there about designers and their facilitation skills and being able to kind of visually bring things to life and create alignment in that way. Because I think that's a really nice way of looking at it, coupled with that idea of incremental improvement, that can help people perhaps to feel more empowered in dealing with some of these wider systemic issues.
Yeah, I love that so much. First of all, I love Sarah. She's just incredible. And yeah, just that idea of like, what can I do from where I sit? Yeah, that just really resonates with me, because one of the examples that I sometimes use was of an intern that I worked with at one of the previous consultancies I was with. And she was kind of tasked on working on this use case that was oriented towards, it was for an emerging technology, and it was a use case that was oriented towards kind of like loyalty customers for either airlines or hotels or something like that. So, you know, business travelers who tend to be, you know, wealthy white men, whatever, you know, the kind you see in sitting in first class a lot. And this just like really, this like just kind of rankled her a little bit. So she came up with another use case that was oriented around, you know, a specific set of people with disabilities, and pitched it to the client. and ended up being able to make a case for it and work on that instead. You know, arguing that is going to benefit others beyond this sort of, you know, narrow demographic. And I think it's like, that is a really good example to me of like, what can you do from where you sit? I mean, there's no one who has less power in that situation, ostensibly, an intern with an external consulting team, like working with a client. Like oftentimes someone like her is not even facing the client, right? And so I think, and a very powerful technology organization. And so I think there is some things that are oriented around mindset. Like, are there things that you can do that you think maybe are beyond your purview as well, but maybe aren't, you know, if you kind of make the right arguments or make the case for it. So, yeah, I mean, I think there's opportunities at every level.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think something that brings up for me is a question that has kind of emerged throughout recording this series, which is, sometimes I wonder if it's about our willingness to engage with complexity, because, you know, and complexity and friction, because it sounds like, as you said, you know, there was a lot of obstacles for her. Like on the surface, it sounds like there wasn't necessarily this straightforward path to achieving the outcome. But actually, it was that willingness to kind of think creatively and engage with that potential friction that was what created the kind of success there. And something that I've been reflecting on as we've kind of gone through the series is that with design systems, there is this real emphasis on simplicity. I work as a design systems consultant, and I think on my website, my tagline says something about championing simplicity and inclusion. And, you know, our emphasis is nearly always on reducing choice for the product teams that are using the design system. So we're thinking like, how can we make this as simple as possible? How can we take away choices? How can we make things as, you know, as straightforward as they can be? And what I've started to wonder, and what I'd love to get your perspective on, is whether that's a slightly misguided goal. And actually, a lot of what we need to do when we're thinking about inclusion and equity and diversity and creating more of that in our society and within our products and services is to actually embrace complexity and be willing to engage with it and be willing to engage with those difficult questions. Because most dimensions of identity, the way that people identify themselves and express themselves and experience the world, seems to be inherently very complex. And I wonder, like, are we just trying to simplify something that is just innately very, very complex?
Yeah, I feel like I totally agree with that. There's this concept that I didn't write about in the book, but I kind of wish I had. You know, Karl Popper, the philosopher, had this sort of concept of cloud problems and clock problems. And so oftentimes, especially in like sort of a technology driven practices, we are thinking about problems the way we would think about building a clock. So, you know, you just need to make it work. It needs to be able to tell time. And so you're problem solving in order to make that happen, in order to make that thing work. And then cloud problems are more nebulous, kind of ambiguous. It could have different kinds of stakeholders. It could have different solutions. You know, we might think about things that we would otherwise call like wicked problems that fall into the cloud problem space. And I think the issue is that some of the things that we funnel into the clock style of problem solving actually are kind of secretly cloud problems, especially if it's like things that are being designed at scale. I think this example was used by someone on Twitter to talk about Twitter and what's happening with Elon Musk. Is just like, he thinks about Twitter as like a clock problem. It's like these various like very directional engineering problems to be solved, when really it's like social and cultural, you know, and economic and political. And these are kind of like things that turn it into a cloud problem that make the space really complex, because, you know, it's like a social platform. And I think, yeah, there's some element of that. Every time we try to sort of simplify things and, you know, kind of directionalize problem solving, we lose a little bit of sight around like, what are kind of not just the other options here in terms of opportunities, but what are the other potential problems here? So Peter Tsang, who wrote the fifth discipline, I'm realizing now I don't even know if I'm pronouncing his name right, but anyway, it's S-E-N-G-E. It's like a classic in terms of systems thinking and organizational change management. One of his principles is yesterday's solutions are today's problems, because anytime we solve anything, it's going to have repercussions, and maybe it's going to have repercussions in a different part of the system, or, you know, directly related to what we're problem solving for. Yeah, I do think there's this resistance to complexity, because what it leads to, you know, embracing that means there's going to be ambiguity, there's going to be uncertainty, and there's only, you know, like, there's going to be also limits to your knowledge in terms of, like, how broad or narrow you kind of think about a problem space. There's one of my favorite concepts in systems thinking is this idea of bounded rationality. Like, I am bound and will only make sort of rational decisions based on just the knowledge that I have. Like, what do I personally know? Which is not much when it comes to any system. Like, it's informed by my own biases, by my own personal experiences. And so what's really an important aspect of systems thinking is that you engage with people who are in various parts of the system so that you can expand the notion of bounded rationality. They're all bound by their limitation in knowledge as well. But by engaging more and more stakeholders who have different roles within the system, whether they're decision makers, whether they're primarily affected by the way the system works, you increase your, or you sort of remove those boundaries a little bit. And so I think that's kind of like an important aspect is of embracing that complexity, is like, understand, like, you can't hold all the cards. Like, you should never go off and make a systems map all by yourself, for example. You should be engaging with people who are multidisciplinary, who sit in different places within the system, and kind of do the work collaboratively with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I think a real kind of alignment that I see between what you're saying and at the beginning of this series, I spoke to David Dylan Thomas about his work around kind of cognitive bias and stuff, is that we're not saying it's a binary. It's not when you talk about bounded rationality, it's not bounded or unbounded. And it's not, we as humans, we are not biased or unbiased. You know, we are all biased, but it's about how we can counterbalance those forces with each other. So it's about how can we, as you say, how we can expand our perspective and our considerations, rather than saying this is a bad thing, we have to get rid of it. It's saying this is an existing thing and we have to cope with it and we have to accommodate it somehow.
Yeah, I love that. Also, David, so great too. I love that book.
Yeah.
I think, I think it's this idea of like, yeah, there aren't really like binaries, right? So it's not like, It kind of drives me up the wall when, like, you know, I'm kind of working on a project and, you know, somebody says something like, we need to eliminate biases within this product, process, whatever it is we're working on. And like, you can't, like, you cannot eliminate bias. You can try to minimize it in certain ways. But like, we're kind of fooling ourselves into thinking like there's some sort of objective thing that would remove bias. It's really not possible. So the best thing to do is to kind of acknowledge it, like embrace like sort of the boundaries of that and do everything you can to extend your thinking so that you can minimize like your own
and offset it, I suppose, with other perspectives and other people, as you said, you know, evolving like as wide a range of stakeholders and users as we can, so that we are offsetting our own biases with other perspectives and other sets of biases, I suppose.
Yeah.
The other thing, it was when you, just to kind of circle back to, you were talking about clock problems and cloud problems, and I've heard that before, but not in kind of detail. And it took me back to a conversation that I had in one of the earlier episodes with somebody called Fred Warburton, who was an accessibility advocate that I worked with at Babylon Health. Very annoyingly, very young and incredibly talented, like one of those people that you want to hate, but is actually really, really nice as well. And he did this incredible amount of accessibility advocacy work at Babylon, kind of awareness of what accessibility was and why it was important and stuff was relatively kind of low at the point that he joined. And within a few weeks of him joining, just by pure coincidence, he discovered that he had a degenerative sight condition called retinitis pigmentosa, and he was losing his sight. And so I suppose partly as a way of coping with it, he became very, very interested in accessibility and how could we make our products more inclusive and stuff. And he just embarked on this journey of discovery as much as anything. You know, he acknowledges he didn't really know much about it before then. And then he had this, you know, very personal interest in it. And something that he says now that he says he would approach differently if he was to do that work again is that the very first thing that they did was start with a product audit. So they looked at how accessible are our products. Let's have them audited against WCAG and see whether they comply or they don't comply with the criteria. And what he says now is that he would start with a baselining exercise still, but that baseline would be focused on people's knowledge and understanding kind of attitudes towards accessibility. And that really reminded me of what you were saying there, because I think the analogy for me is like the WCAG compliance or not is almost like the clock problem, you know, and the thinking about kind of attitudes and the culture and the receptiveness of an organization to make our products and services more inclusive and accessible is the cloud problem. Like that's the really messy kind of complicated thing. And his point was, which I think is a really good one, that if you are only focusing on achieving a kind of level of compliance, you're going to achieve it, but at a point in time. And if the knowledge and the willingness to engage in the work to make things more accessible is not there, then that's going to fall away again, you know, as our products and services, as new software versions come out, as things evolve, those problems are just going to creep back in again because they haven't been dealt with at the root cause, which is that ultimately people don't really appreciate and understand why accessibility is important.
Right. Yeah. I think that's such a good example of how individuals and organizations need to experience kind of like a mindset shift work in order to even be ready for that, right? In order to even be ready for something like a rubric. I get asked a lot by organizations that I work with, you know, especially in the equity-centered design space, like, can we just have like a checklist to see like if our product is equitable? And I'm just like, that's kind of like a wild thing to ask just because I think there's this weird sort of focus on the product or like the end product rather than sort of the organizational or kind of like institutional change that needs to happen in order for something to, yeah, be authentically equitable. Like, you can't use like a rubric to say, okay, this, let's say digital, this digital reading tool that we're developing for primary school students. Let's like check a box that says, oh, it has racial representation in the pictures. That's not going to make like an equitable product. And one of the reasons for that is because that's just like one, like a singular expression. These kinds of tools, like it's funny, like I didn't know it was pronounced like WCAG or what have you. I always
call WCAG. It might be a UK thing. I think we tend to call it WCAG, and I think I've heard people from the US call it like something else, either like just WCAG or like WCAG or something. Yeah. So I think we maybe call it slightly differently.
It's making me realize it's one of those things, you know, where there are words where you've only read them and not heard them. But I love WCAG. Like, I'm just like, oh, I love that so much. It's kind of like, it reminds me, just an aside, of like this TikTok I saw where like a French child saw LGBTQ and she was saying, oh, that's Legibus Qua. And I was like, oh my gosh, I love how that sounds. I want to say that from now on, like, logistical.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the WCAG, for example, is it's really just like, it's a way of just kind of like verifying some of the work that you've already done. But it shouldn't, it can't be the starting point, because I think, like you're saying, like, you're not going to inherently start working towards that, you know, as you continue like working on your product or whatever. You're just going to use it as an evaluative mechanism every now and then. And that's not, I don't know, that's not systemic change, basically. So yeah, I totally agree with that. And so one of the things that I talk about is like, especially when it comes to like equity or when you're thinking in systems, there's like the mindset shift, there's like the process shift, and then there's kind of like the tools you use in order to be able to achieve those first two things. And that could be at the organization level, it could be at the individual level, but those things kind of need to happen first in order for you to be able to, yeah, kind of do that, engage with that kind of work authentically.
Uh-huh. And I suppose then with that in mind, so the kind of focus of this series is people who are working on design systems and what power they have to either perpetuate systemic harm or mitigate it if that's what they kind of choose to do. So I guess, how do you see the role of design systems in that kind of framework that you just set out there? So when thinking about kind of mindset shifts and process shifts, and then we're thinking about tooling, how do you see that kind of mapping to design systems work?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because I haven't worked, you know, I'm just going to put this out there. I haven't worked like directly on design systems, but I've done some like projects where we're doing strategic thinking about like how a design system, what are the things like an organization needs to think about as they're developing their design system, like let's say 5 years out, 10 years out, what have you. And I think that there's a couple of things. I mean, as you said earlier, designing design systems, it's inherently about, yeah, turning things into like super simple components so that you can do kind of like replicable work. And I think one of the issues with that kind of the mindset inherent to that is that it feels like if you do it right away, then you shouldn't have to do anything else later. And anyone who's worked on design systems will know, like, design systems are living things, like they're constantly evolving. And so if you take that approach, it will fail and perhaps not even be able to work as a system in the short term. I did some work with an organization where there was like a guy who is off somewhere else, like this remote worker on the design team, but not really on the design team, and just like working individually, like on the design system. They'd be like, so-and-so is just like, oh, he's over there working on the design system. And I'm like, what? That is just like such a, like, I don't know. It's like you're almost setting him up and setting that system up for failure, because like you can't just like go off into a corner and work on a design system. You kind of have to understand broadly how the organization functions, how they're going to access this, like what are the patterns of use going to be, in addition to like the patterns of components that you're designing. There's like this meta level of thinking you need to do organizationally in order to engage in designing a design system. And then kind of beyond that, it is like thinking about those components in a way that, you know, like referring back to our previous discussion about like gender and names and things like that, and kind of play out how these things need to be adaptable in a way, right? How your components need to be adaptable and how you need to be able to change them in order to respond to potential problems. I do think like systems thinking has some intersection here in that there's, you can use like some of the frameworks from systems thinking in order to try to anticipate what some of the issues might be as you kind of like move forward in your work. And it, there is like looking at a design system from that meta level, like how is it going to work from an organizational standpoint? What are future technologies that might intersect with this that we need to understand and either incorporate or to be able to address, you know, like GPT sort of AI is being incorporated into like various design systems already. And I think like, so how do you kind of like address that? Like, how do you be able to anticipate what you might need to think about, both from like an opportunity perspective and also from an unintended consequences perspective? In many ways, it's like designing for anything else. It's just a design system. In many ways, is like larger and probably involves a lot more people in terms of like who your stakeholders are going to be.
Yeah, and I think that's such a, the ChatGPT thing is so interesting and so fresh in my mind at the moment, especially when we're talking about unintended consequences, because the thing that I'm really seeing a lot of people around me doing right now is just playing in that opportunity space and going like, this is amazing. I don't have to write documentation anymore. It just put in, write me a documentation for a button component and it writes it. And it really concerns me. And I do have a bias here that I need to acknowledge, which is that part of my job, part of the work I do in my consultancy is technical writing, right? So it just kind of directly threatens what I do in some ways. But it concerns me because a thing that I say often is design systems are not just harmless scaling machines. They are certainly scaling machines, but they're not inherently harmless. You know, they're not neutral. It's what we put into them. And that comes from culture and attitudes and, you know, the kind of structure of our organizations and all these and all the biases and all the things that we've talked about today. And so stuff like ChatGPT that is just adding more automation and more kind of mindlessness to the situation really worries me, I think. And so, yeah, I think that's kind of a really helpful thing that you talk about in your book is how to start considering unintended consequences and stuff and how to start building that questioning into your work, because I think it's so important for especially people who are working on design systems where there's that added layer of multiplication, you know?
Yeah. And I, it's interesting, like one of my favorite tools is it from, that I wrote about in the book is probably one of the simplest. It's the futures wheel. So this can be used to like interrogate just what the radiating effects might be for anything that you're working on. And so you could take something like, oh, integrating GPT into our design system or integrating this into anything we're designing and just sort of like play out scenarios from like the second or third degree or what have you in terms of like how they might play out, positive or negative. And it doesn't have to be entirely focused on harm. Like, it was kind of interesting because I, like you, I have my own biases kind of like against this kind of automation. I think it has an impact in some ways, like on our creativity and our ability to problem solve or like think about like left field kind of ideas and things like that. And like, and just like as an educator as well, I teach at University of Washington and I'm like, oh my gosh, I don't have any idea if my students are using GPT for some of the things that they're submitting, but it does worry me that it narrows our lens in terms of what we're creatively capable of. And then I talked to somebody the other weekend who was talking about how like English is her second language and that she's been using GPT just to kind of like take a stab at some of the things she was trying to write. And just like she was running through some of the things she was writing just to make it sound more grammatically fluid and maybe more native English speaker accessible and things like that. And I was like, that's actually a really super interesting opportunity that has repercussions in and of itself. But I do think like it helped me kind of think about like, oh, so if I were to run that, for example, as one of the examples within a futures wheel, how would I see that play out in terms of like potential consequences, like good or bad? And I think it's a good way to like stay nuanced when we're thinking about any of these things. And it's important to me to not let my, you know, like I'm always kind of thinking about like, what things am I sort of fretting about that are, that feel like moral panic or not, right? And so how can I kind of temper that, but also not get caught up in like the techno-optimism that tends to like sort of envelop the industry in which I primarily work. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's just like, I think nuance is just like really important, especially like as we're kind of like thinking about these complex systems and even designing things like design systems.
Yeah, I think that is a really good place for us to end, because I think actually stay nuanced is like where I want to, it's like where I really want to end the series on, because I think it's such an important message. And I do think, as I say, there's been this kind of emerging theme of like, is simplification actually a desirable goal for us, especially those of us working on design systems, which are so inherently complex and have intersections with all this other complexity that they affect and that they influence. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you, and I'm so excited. I'm about halfway through your book at this point, and I'm so excited to finish it because, yeah, I've already, as I said to you kind of at the beginning of this conversation, I've just started highlighting bits that were interesting to me, and the whole thing is now highlighted. So I certainly recommend that people buy your book, and I will include a link to it in the show notes, and I'll mention it as well in the outro, as well as the discount code that you have shared with us. If people want to just find out more about you and your work, where is the best place for them to reach you or to go?
Yeah, so you can find me on LinkedIn. Yeah, feel free to connect with me there. And that's also where I post things like where my subsequent speaking engagements are and things like that. And I am on Twitter, though I don't check it as often as I used to. It feels like there's like a little bit of an exodus from that platform. So,
oh yeah, it's a real graveyard now. It's very depressing.
But if you feel like connecting with me there, I might get back to you in a month. So, but yeah, those are the places where you can find me. And yeah, thanks, Amy. This has been such a good conversation.
Lovely. Oh, thank you so much for coming on. That was Cheryl Kababa, author of Closing the Loop, Systems Thinking for Designers. Listeners of Systems of Harm can get 15% off by using the code Kababa-SO, which is CABABA-SOH. That's CABABA-SOH. Find a link to Cheryl's book in today's show notes. And that brings the series of Systems of Harm to a close. I'm not sure yet if there's going to be another one, but I hope that you've enjoyed listening to this one as much as I've enjoyed making it. For updates on the podcast and my other work, you can find me on Twitter at Amy_Hoop, or head to my website, amyhoop.co.uk, for more information. Take care of yourselves, and I hope to see you soon. Bye for now.